And there's like so many different fallacies or mistakes in using something like the full body count from a decade-long civil war that was contributed to by a range of actors that should not have been contributing to it, to a month-long conflict that has killed 10,000 people.
Hello and welcome to the More Freedom Foundation podcast. We are your hosts, Rory McElhone, and political expert and author Robert Morris.
I'm never comfortable with being described as an expert. I think I'm just an inspired amateur with a little more time to focus on this stuff than most people have, and a little less bias. So I think it was you who formulated it. You know, it's just we have the. Nice thing about this podcast is we have the freedom to be honest, and I really like that formulation you came up with, and I think that today we're going to be diving back into Israel and Palestine.
The reason I've been avoiding the news for the past month.
Yeah, it is. I wish I could have just avoided the news. But this is my job. This is the best job on the planet, I maintain. Certainly the best job I've ever had. And sometimes that means diving into really, really uncomfortable stuff. And that has certainly been my experience over the past month.
What way has the political divide gone down with the American people?
It's incredibly unpleasant because it plays with a lot of dynamics and cleavages that people don't want to talk about, don't really want to think about. One of the most obvious ones is that younger people in the United States are really not very interested in the standard narrative of Israeli heroism that we've been consuming for the past half century, really. It's interesting that the sort of like quite straightforward, Israel's our ally, we're on Israel's side stuff, actually came about a good deal later than you might expect. It wasn't directly after the Holocaust and the founding of Israel, when most of the U.S. establishment and U.S. media was still pretty leery of the idea of Israel. It was more in the 1960s and 1970s that this these sort of narratives centralized. And I think what we're seeing is sort of the breakdown of that narrative in some pretty strange ways. I think, as I am a North American and I live in New York City, it is incumbent upon me to mention that this conflict began on October 7th with a truly horrific attack on Israel by Hamas. It is often compared to Israel's 9/11, and I think as we discussed shortly after the attack, that doesn't come close to close to encompassing just how brutal and horrific this was for the Israeli people. People that had become accustomed to a certain low level of antagonism from the Palestinian populations that, I mean, let's not to put too far, but that they have been oppressing, and to see that blow up in such a horrific way is something that should never be minimized. However, I think as distinct from when we recorded this podcast, last touched on this topic in this podcast, we've now seen the balance of horror and the balance of crimes, frankly, switch in ways, to put it quite simply. What is happening in Gaza is horrific. What the Israeli state is doing to the Palestinian people in Gaza is horrific. I think we knew, and I think this is why my initial response was certainly disappointing to friends of mine, family members, some Jewish Americans, some not, who were initially rightly focused on how horrific this attack was, whereas I could see that this attack in some ways necessitated, but was going to inevitably lead to much, much greater horror being committed by the Israeli government. And over the past month, we've seen that play out. And I think it's just really important to sort of point out at the outset, like, Hamas is a monstrous, disgusting organization. And the Israeli government's actions over the past month have matched and exceeded the disgusting actions of a monstrous, disgusting organization. I feel like so much of the commentary here puts the Israeli government on the same level as Hamas, as if it is somehow appropriate it doesn't matter that the Israeli government has killed 4,000 kids because Hamas killed 1,000 kids. And, you know, it's we have to go do this. And it's just that logic does not make a lot of sense to me if we are maintaining that the Israeli government is a civilized actor that we are supposed to support wholeheartedly. To be clear again, like I don't have the Zionism I was raised with any longer, but I'm firmly committed to the existence of Israel. I believe it is there. And importantly, I don't currently believe it's under any threat. And I think that's a very key point in the comparisons that we may talk about here, is I do not think that Hamas poses any serious threat to Israeli life. What happened on October 7th was a really, really irresponsible policy on the part of this Israeli government and a number of Israeli governments over the past decades blew up in their faces. The Netanyahu government was very focused on using the Israeli military to back up settlers who were carrying out, frankly, ethnic cleansing against a population of Palestinians represented by a government that has been working closely with the Israeli government for 20 years. That's where Netanyahu wanted to put his soldiers. That's where he wanted to focus. And he was in this sort of fantasy about, oh, we've got this high-tech Gaza barrier. We've got our remote-controlled machine gun robots. We don't need to worry about it. And plus, because we're sort of working under the table with Hamas through Qatar, you know, they're trying to, you know, we've got that handled. And oh my God, did Netanyahu not have that handled? I think the guilt of this is of course with Hamas, this gross organization, the disgusting individuals who carried out all of the horrific acts that we've heard about. But as far as the player here with the most power to keep those attacks of October 7th from happening, that would be Benjamin Netanyahu. And I think that really the first thing that needs to happen for anybody to move forward, even if it is with a horrific military situation in Gaza, solution in Gaza, is to get rid of Netanyahu and to get him out of power.
But if he's not in power, he could go to jail, Rob.
That's a good point. That's a good point, Rory. We should definitely continue this horrific eliminationist war so we can keep Bibi out of jail.
Benjamin Netanyahu like Erdogan in the sense he's able to just flip and change whatever way he needs to stay in power?
Well, I think Netanyahu has tried to be a number of things to a number of different people over the course of his time in power. And that is somewhat Erdogan-like. Erdogan has certainly is diametrically, the Erdogan of 2023 embraces a lot of policy approaches and agenda items that are diametrically opposed to the Erdogan of 2004. I think Netanyahu has been pretty consistent. And I think that's another reason why we should question the narrative that October 7th happened and now Israel can do absolutely anything it wants forever, is because for over a decade, at some points in and out, Netanyahu was in power and was doing everything he could to make the situation between the Palestinians and the Israelis worse. It's documented. We have quotes. I mean, there's a quote from 2019 that's been sort of bandied about. I don't have it at my fingertips, but essentially him saying that, you know, if you oppose a two-state solution, as I do, you need to support Hamas, as we do. You know, that is what Netanyahu did. I think that can be a little overblown. You know, maybe, you know, he was drunk. Maybe he was putting things a little too explicitly. But I don't think it's wrong to say that the Netanyahu government vastly preferred the violent eliminationist Palestinian government in Gaza to the government that attempted to work with the Israelis and acknowledge the existence of Israel in the West Bank, because he wants the fight to continue. He wants the Palestinians to look like murderous savages, which is what Hamas is, rather than the people in the West Bank who tried desperately for 20 years to work with him and other Israeli governments. So yes, absolutely, October 7th required a horrific a response that would be portrayed by folks as horrific, but I don't think people are reckoning with the fact that it is decades of conscious policy by the Netanyahu government and other governments that have led, Israeli governments, that led to the attacks of October 7th, and that the October 7th attacks are being used to follow a truly disgusting agenda of ethnic cleansing. I'm very confident calling it that. According to the definition of genocide that the United Nations uses, which I actually don't like, then what Israel is doing is genocidal. I've talked in the context of the Uyghurs, in the context of Russia and Ukraine, in the context of the Armenians, that I don't really like using the term genocide, because what the United Nations understands genocide to mean is vastly more expansive than what the general public understands genocide to mean. But according to the definition of genocide that we've been using to accuse the Chinese government, the Russian government, over the past decade, the Israeli government is absolutely committing that. And that is the expansion of the idea of genocide to go beyond mere extermination to the idea of pushing people out of lands, taking activities that are destructive to the life of a people. Again, I don't prefer to apply the term genocide in this case, or the Chinese case, or the Russian case. I think it's inflammatory and stops conversations rather than and confuses people, frankly. But according to the definition, again, according to the definition of genocide that we've been throwing in China and Russia's face, that is absolutely what the Israeli government is committing here, and it is absolutely what the United States government is supporting. Before we get into the rest of this, I think I just want to say one thing about the body counts. The figure that we're running with as of Thursday, November 9th, is 10,000 dead in Gaza. It's very interesting that the president of the United States, for the first time, I believe, in the history of this conflict, has chosen to question the numbers, because the numbers are so horrifically large. Biden was like, well, I don't know. That's Hamas's Ministry of Health. We don't know if those numbers are real. And of course, because Biden has said that, that is, you know, we're talking about just sort of the discussion. You had asked about the discussion in the United States. And now this, coupled with the fact that a couple Western news organizations may have overemphasized or misattributed the body count for one attack in the early days of this conflict, those have been combined to create this narrative where, oh, it's all BS, and Hamas says 10,000 people have been killed, and that's not the case. And speaking as someone who does have a little more time to look into this stuff, that is utterly incorrect. First, on one level, the Gaza Health Ministry's numbers have always been respected. Are being used by Israeli media at this point.
But aren't Gaza hospitals generally run by the UN?
Well, Gaza hospitals are often run by the UN and other aid organizations from other countries. I mean, there was an Indonesian hospital that had been attacked, among a number of hospitals that have been attacked. But also, and what really extraordinary is, every person in Gaza has a Israeli identification number, which kind of puts the, an identification number that is somehow facilitated through the Israeli government, which I think puts this conflict in a light that people don't really want to think about. I view Gazans and West Bank Palestinians, frankly, as Israeli citizens. They have no real government, neither of them, that exercises any kind of real sovereignty. And when Biden came out and said that at this point there was a mere 7,000 people having been slaughtered, Biden came out and questioned those numbers, and the Gaza Ministry of Health sent out a spreadsheet with the list of all of the 7,000 people that they had collected as dead, including their Israeli/Gazan identification numbers. At no other point in this conflict has any NGO or organization questioned these numbers. And to be clear, if there was grounds to question these numbers, the Israeli government and a wide array of organizations in the United States that work closely with the Israeli government would be doing a lot of work to discard those numbers. Unfortunately, I think they've correctly judged that, we can just talk about that one hospital attack that was misattributed 3 weeks ago, and we can say, we can look at Biden saying we don't know if those numbers are real, and we can just pretend these numbers are made up. This controversy has been resolved to my satisfaction with a news story we saw today in The Hill. The Hill is a Washington, D.C. focused periodical. I generally see it as much more right-leaning, and it's sort of pretty right-leaning and pretty pro-war.
So as pro-Israel as you're going to get?
There are you can go much further towards pro-Israel, infinitely further towards propagandizing on behalf of the Israeli government than The Hill does. I think The Hill is a responsible, respected institution, and they were documenting Barbara Leaf, a U.S. State Department undersecretary, I believe, so a fairly high-ranking U.S. State Department official who told Congress, I believe yesterday or perhaps it was today, that the 10,000 figure for deaths that we're using is way, way too low. It turns out that the Gaza Health Ministry is exclusively totting up the deaths of the bodies they can recover. I think you've probably seen footage of what Gaza looks like right now, strikingly reminiscent of Dresden during World War II, recognized by most as one of the most horrific aerial bombing campaigns in human history. That's what Gaza looks like right now. So the 10,000 that I believe as of this recording on Thursday, November 9th, that the Gaza Health Ministry is running with is the corpses they could recover.
That's horrendous.
Yeah. So I would strongly urge people listening to this to not listen to anybody who's trying to minimize those figures. In Israel, certain elements of the Israeli government and the Israeli press are saying, no, no, that 10,000 is really, really low because we've killed all these Hamas members in the tunnels. I mean, they're saying, no, these numbers are low as well. And the U.S. government, the U.S. State Department, is saying that 10,000 is a underestimate, or likely an underestimate. So there's no
Benjamin
question.
Benjamin Netanyahu once claimed that for every dead Israeli, they would kill 20 Palestinians.
I don't know the
this
details.
Isn't this specific conflict. This was, you know, years ago, but it does seem like they're hell-bent in recreating that.
Well, the sad fact is, Ruri, that in all of these conflicts, that's the 10-to-1 ratio is usually what happens. A certain number of Israelis are killed, and then 10 times as many. The fighting tends to stop, or perhaps the international pressure grows enough when the sort of 10-to-1 figure is exceeded. Because of the horror of the attacks on October 7th, those usual governors are not not active. The U.S. government acknowledges that, I suppose, well, you know, 1,400 Israelis were killed. I suppose when we get to an official number of 14,000 dead Palestinians, then perhaps we can talk about, you know, maybe the 10-to-1 ratio is going to have start having an impact. But yeah, it's incredibly dark, and these numbers are very, very high. I think I'll probably do a more rigorous version of this in a couple weeks when frankly I expect the numbers of death in Gaza to exceed anything that has happened this century.
Is that they've killed more civilians than Russia has during its recent conflicts, which is just horrific.
Oh yeah.
And when you consider the amount of finger wagging America did to Russia, it's basically like, well, now you're essentially doing the exact, well, much worse.
Yeah. And the key thing to remember here is that they've killed these many civilians in a month. The civilian deaths we're talking about, the civilians that Russia has killed, We're talking about most of 2 years at this point. To be clear, Rory, you can absolutely find estimates out there that say that the Russians have actually killed 40,000 civilians, or this, that, the other thing. But I believe that it's Ukrainian government statistics that say around that this war has killed around 10,000 Ukrainian civilians. And that's, again, out of a population of 40 million, more or less, Ukrainians. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Rather than the 2 million Gazans we're talking about.
Well, to bring it back to your September 11th analogy, what is currently happening to Gaza is like makes it look like a much smaller incident when you consider their population.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, it is quite hellish. As I pointed out, it depends on how you measure it. And there's a lot of, it's interesting. One of your initial questions that I failed to answer correctly was like, how is it looking in the sort of American information space? As I think I mentioned the last time we talked about this, the Israel-Palestine conflict is the one international issue that regularly spills over onto my personal, you know, friends and family Instagram account, as opposed to the Instagram account I maintain for the
More Freedom Foundation.
Yeah, for the More Freedom Foundation. It has been fascinating and incredibly depressing to watch the evolution of that over the past month. I had a lot of people who never weigh in on political affairs. I'd say quite understandably horrified by the attacks of October 7th. Dear Jewish American friends of mine who talked about the insecurity that this made them feel, the sort of historical trauma that this brought up, and making some very strident demands about how we should all treat that and think about that attack and 100% back up the Israeli government and what they were doing. It's kind of interesting now, a month later, most of those voices have gone silent. Most of my normie friends have moved on. Some of my friends, either they were before or they have become much more committed to the Israeli cause. And it is fascinating how the language has shifted. 3 weeks ago, it was, you know, everybody must band together to crush Hamas. This is a wave of anti-Semitism. And to be clear, there is a wave of anti-Semitic attacks taking place in the United States, just as there is a wave of Islamophobic attacks. Those strident voices on my personal Instagram account have now changed. And they're saying, well, really, if you're not Jewish, and it's fascinating because they incorporate, if you're not Jewish or Muslim or likely to be a target of anti-Semitism or Islamophobia, stop commenting about this. Stop paying attention. It's not your conflict. You don't have the right to talk about this as if it's an act of appropriation or racism to even discuss this conflict anymore. So we've got 3 weeks and a month ago, it's you absolutely must be outraged and insist that the U.S. government gets as committed to this as possible. And now these folks who, and this isn't like a sinister thing to say, I mean, the way Instagram works is there are memes that people repost. Most of my Instagram stuff is stuff that I say, but most meme wars around politics are just reposting other things. And the quality of things that people repost is changing very strongly. And what is being reposted now is not stand with Israel, back us up to the hilt. It's stop paying attention. This isn't your business. And I think that's frankly really sinister, because it is certainly the business of the U.S. taxpayer that is paying for this in large part. But it is in the interest of humanity to focus on this extraordinarily murderous crime. I think, you know, is it the worst thing that has happened this century? I think the worst thing that has happened this century in terms of loss of life and imbalance of the conflict is probably still that first month of the George W. Bush administration going into Iraq. I think the figures of Iraqis killed are something like 30,000 people in a month. Truly, truly horrific. There's a lot of very fuzzy math and sort of, frankly, deeply ignorant misattributions. I'm not just talking about memes on Instagram now. I'm talking about the Atlantic Monthly. There was an article by Simon Sebag Montefiore, who's an excellent writer. I've enjoyed some of his books in the past and Russian history. Though, interestingly, his book on Jerusalem, I read about a decade ago, actually played a key part in demolishing the sort of Zionism that I grew up with, because his account was so blatantly one-sided that I was like, oh, this is absurd. And he took to the pages of the Atlantic Monthly to craft an intervention of that ilk a couple weeks back. And in that, he said, well, you can't talk about, if you're talking about what Israel's doing in Gaza, you're an anti-Semite, because Bashar Assad killed 500,000 people in Syria. And it's just like, wow. I mean, first off, over 100,000, if not over 200,000, I haven't looked at the number, of the people killed in Syria were Assad's soldiers. Assad did not do that. What happened in Syria was certainly the responsibility of Bashar Assad, but it was also the responsibility of the United States, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and a number of other countries that poured billions of dollars into creating this civil war. And there's like so many different fallacies or mistakes in using something like the full body count from a decade-long civil war that was contributed to by a range of actors that should not have been contributing to it, to a month-long conflict that has killed 10,000 people. I looked a little bit into like individual months of the Syrian conflict, and it's possible that you could point to a few months in perhaps 2015 or 2016 or like 2013, 2014, where you had body counts of this size, but that was multiple actors. The Russians, the Americans, the Islamic State, a wide range of, I mean, that was a war. This is not really a war. This is a really horrific policing action that is extraordinarily one-sided. And I do believe will very quickly, if it's allowed to continue at the pace that it has, blow any crime this century out of the water. Another sort of, I saw this on a meme and it bugs me so much. Someone pointed out, well, the Congo, 45,000 people are dying a month in the Congo and you don't care about that. And it's just like, that's excess death estimates in one study in 2009 that said that because of the fact that Congo is essentially ungoverned, there are, according to one study from 2009 that did get a lot of play, 45,000 people a month may have been dying of starvation or disease or a variety of complications. And I don't want to minimize that. I believe it's a country of 80 million, 80 to 100 million. I mean, that's horrific. Those numbers strike me as probably a little bit high, but that is an indisputable horror related to a lack of development. Not related to an American bomb flying through the top of your school.
Also, when you're comparing yourself to the Congo, something's gone terribly wrong.
Yes. So I think it's not, I mean, there are still some months of the Syrian civil war that are a bit worse. There's absolutely that first month of the United States rampaging into Iraq that might be a bit worse. But this is on the level of the worst things that have happened this century. And it is barely starting.
Can you see this dividing some of America's allies, or at least making them less in favor of agreeing with America and going along with its ideas?
What's been interesting is how little dissent there has been in Europe from my perspective. I do think that things are shifting
just
a little
Ireland
bit.
On its own.
Ireland is dissenting from
the... Oh, well, it's always been sort of pro-Palestinian, and there was a bit of a small ruckus when the UN, or the EU was saying that, you know, its full sympathies are with Israel, and Ireland was a bit like, we didn't agree to this. So both the Taoiseach and the President were annoyed by that, but, you know, we're just a small country.
Well, I think that there is... Well, I guess what we should talk about now is what the Israeli government wants to do. And I can't speak to what the mass of the Israeli public wants. I think there's been shifts within the Israeli public. I think in the initial week or so after these horrific attacks on October 7th, the kill 'em all attitude was very prevalent in, I mean, one of the reasons I've spent my life doing this project is that's what I was for 2 years after 9/11. And as I've said, 9/11 was a tempest in a teapot compared to, you know, what the effects of the October 7th attacks are on Israeli politics. So in the initial week, the Israeli public was, you know, let's kill them all. The Israeli government has been on that kill them all train and remains on that kill them all train. It's not that the Netanyahu wants to wade in, you know, knee-deep blood of Palestinians or anything like that. He just wants them gone. And that's a very, I mean, that is ethnic cleansing.
Isn't that the problem with the demographics? If you add Israel and Palestine, they're roughly 50-50.
I did the math a while ago. And okay. I don't think so. Really, I think it's sort of 10 million Israelis, which does include, I think, 1.5 to 2 million Israeli Arabs. And then you've got, I think it's only 5 or 6 million all told between the West Bank and Gaza. I might be completely wrong about that. I haven't looked into the numbers. But I just sort of thinking, like, I think that Israel is in much better control of the Palestinian populations than the Israeli propaganda would.
And also a big part of the, you know, why there's so many children in Palestine is it's just a sign of poverty. Generally, when countries are poor, they have significantly more children, and the richer they get, the less children they have. So it's not necessarily they're trying to outbreed them. It's just a sign of poverty. When is it the ultra-Orthodox are having very large families?
Yeah. Yes, I believe that's the case. That's very fraught territory we're getting into here, Ruri, and I have not prepared for it adequately, so I don't want to say anything too conclusively one way or the other. What is also very fraught territory, and I have prepared to a degree, is the extent to which the intent of the current Israeli government is, I'll just say it, genocidal. Not meaning they want to set up death camps or anything like that. They absolutely, I mean, most of them don't want to do that. We did famously have the heritage minister. I don't know exactly what a heritage minister is, but he is part of the Netanyahu government, say that he wanted to nuke Gaza. This was supposed to get him in trouble more for the public admission that Israel has nuclear weapons.
But also you shouldn't use nuclear weapons on nations right beside you.
Yes.
That's quite stupid. It's best if they're very far away.
I don't think anybody thinks that this is a practical possibility. But the fact that the sentiment was expressed by a sitting member of the Netanyahu government is very worth marking. And I think it was worth marking enough that it sort of made it into mainstream news accounts. In preparing for this, I read The Economist's coverage of what was going on in Israel-Gaza. And I think The Economist's perspective is that Israel should stay the course, go do what they're doing. It's the right thing to do. And that is the sort of the perspective of a lot of the media in the United States and in Europe. And I found the article useful in terms of, you know, okay, the attacks happened on October 7th. On October 27th, the ground invasion of Gaza started. They provide casualty figures and don't make any bones about what they are. But I found the discussion of the Israeli government incredibly limited. And I think that's one of the main downfalls, the main things that's being missed. Not missed, I would say consciously ignored in the media accounts in the United States and Europe. This government wants to get rid of the Palestinians. And that's horrific. That's like, that is next level crimes against humanity. Genocide is an appropriate term to use here. And again, I'm not saying Netanyahu wants to set up death camps. He just wants to move all the Gazans into the Egyptian desert. And that's established. And I think that that established fact should be front and center in every discussion of, you know, this was like a 3 or 4 page thing I read in The Economist. And that just wasn't to be mentioned. There was an Economist article 2 or 3 weeks ago that mentioned in a really horrifyingly clinical way, like, can we bribe the Egyptians into accepting the population of Gaza?
Because doesn't Egypt already have a massive influx of immigrants? So just to expect them to take a nation or one half of a nation?
Well, the key detail here is that and I think it's fascinating because some of my most strident advocates for Israel in my Instagram feed are like, why won't Egypt take these refugees? Why won't Egypt take these refugees? And it sounds like a very straightforward humanitarian thing. Why won't they take these refugees? Because the Israeli government has made it abundantly clear that their intention is that the refugees be taken and they never come back. It's not a question of humanitarianism here. I think that if it were solely a question of humanitarianism, then yes, obviously you'd want all the Gazans to leave. But that's the point of this operation, is to make the north of Gaza uninhabitable. In the first days of the conflict, Israel announced that everybody in Gaza had to move below a certain line about halfway through the Gaza Strip.
Because isn't it roughly the size of Manhattan?
It's I can't speak to that, but it is very, very large. And I can speak to the fact that it included almost all of Gaza City, the most densely populated center of people in Gaza, with hospitals, with people. And it is, I believe, that out of the 2.2 million or what have you, the population of Gaza, 1.4 million people are now displaced in a month.
Yeah, that's outstanding.
Do you know how many refugees all of Europe took from Syria?
Like 2?
1.
Okay.
1 million.
Yeah.
They took 1 million refugees from the Syrian conflict. 1.4 have now been sloshed to the bottom of Gaza. There was a really moving, I was very surprised to see this on CNN, actually. There's a very moving account of, perhaps this is why you saw it on CNN, an attractive blonde nurse who had been working in Gaza. Anderson Cooper gave her a full 8 minutes to just talk about the true horror of what's going on in southern Gaza. I mean, they don't have water. They don't have fuel. She was talking about, as a privileged doctor and member of, I believe, Médecins Sans Frontières, the Doctors Without Borders, she had trouble getting drinking water. The Israeli government refused to allow any aid into Gaza between October 7th and October 21st for a 2-week period. While Netanyahu was pressuring the U.S. government and the Egyptian government to figure out how to move all the Gazans into Egypt, that should be front and center in every discussion of this conflict. That the Israeli government, the current Israeli government, wants to ethnically cleanse Gaza, and that should be utterly disqualifying for the Netanyahu government. Like, I would love a ceasefire. I know there won't be one.
I think they've agreed to like a 2-hour ceasefire a day or something.
Yeah, that's actually strikingly reminiscent of Putin policies in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think there'll be a ceasefire. I really don't think under any Israeli government that most people are ever going to be moving back to northern Gaza. I think that Gaza is shrinking. That's what's going to be the result of this conflict. But to continue to work with Netanyahu, a guy who's explicitly tried to eradicate a nation, that's what he wants to do. He wants to rip the 2 million Gazans away from their land. And that's just, that should be the in the first paragraph of every discussion of this conflict. And you know what? The liberal guy is still going to, if he was the prime minister, is still going to stamp out half of Gaza. I mean, that's what's happening. But it is unconscionable that we're still pretending that Netanyahu is an appropriate person to be running Israel or running this conflict.
Has this affected Joe Biden's popularity?
There's some. The question is, what is affecting Joe Biden's popularity? The U.S. media pinned Afghanistan on him instead of the generals that ignored 2 years of two U.S. presidents telling them to create a withdrawal plan, and that took his approval ratings down to Trump level and below. They're now even more abysmal. I think Trump mostly hovered around the 40% approval rating when he was president. I believe Biden is now in the mid-30s, mid to high 30s or something. It is atrocious, and there has absolutely been a connection to this Israel-Palestine war. Is it affinity with the Palestinians? Is it just sheer outrage at being expected to send billions of dollars to yet another foreign war? It is worth emphasizing just how completely discrediting this conflict is. For 2 years, as you pointed out, Rory, we've been talking about the horrors of Putin, the horrors of what he's doing to civilians, this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We have to stand up for the little guy against this incredible oppressor. And in the view of more Americans than you'd think, and most of the rest of the world, we're now supporting the exact same thing, or actually significantly worse, in Gaza. So that's really fundamentally discrediting. And I think even in the United States, that's pretty discrediting as well. And I think a lot of people are getting pretty sick, and which is a good thing, getting pretty sick of all the constant warring that we're expected to pay for.
Is this very bad news for Ukraine, as it seems like they may have to come to some sort of agreement and, you know, give away land since so much emphasis is now on Israel?
No question. I do think the two things have been over connected in the popular discussion. I think it's which is really not great for a Ukrainian populace that has got a really dark history with anti-Semitism to sort of create this new stabbed in the back by Israel legend is a really, really bad thing. I mean, Ukraine is one of the most, it struck me as one of the most openly anti-Semitic places I've ever been, which has always impacted the degree to which I am sympathetic to Ukraine. Obviously, having a Jewish president is a huge step away from that. But Zelensky is now in a terrible, terrible position, and Israel is absolutely taking attention and funds away from Ukraine. However, the Ukrainian offensive was already petering out before October 7th. I think definitely since October 7th, the Ukrainians have realized that, oh, crap, like this vital source of funding from the United States is a lot more vulnerable. So they've, I believe, the head of the Ukrainian armed forces took to The Economist to talk about how there was a stalemate, how they desperately needed more equipment and technology and this, that, and the other thing. And I do think that this restart of the Israel conflict has certainly exacerbated a really negative situation that Ukraine is in, but I think it really overstates it. I think that Ukraine would have been in this situation anyway. Maybe it would have taken another month or two before reality really set in and folks started talking about it so seriously. Europe actually needs to step up now. I don't think the United States is going to like pull out funding or anything like that, but every 3 to 6 months, here's another $50 billion. I think that's probably reaching the end. The question is, can Europe be as generous as they want to be. The fact is, we have created a new South Korea in the middle of the Soviet Union's industrial heartland. We're not going to abandon it. But I do think that in the United States, there is a recognition that at a certain point, we're not going to continue to support them to the degree that we have. And that's, and this is something that I was expecting since the, I was at October, it was just about this time last year, I believe, the Russians mobilized. And it's just the mismatch in numbers there is just so extreme. That I thought we'd probably seen the last of the impressive Ukrainian victories, and unfortunately that has proven to be the case. So, Israel, the Israel-Palestine thing, and the fact that that's such a lucrative opportunity for the U.S. military-industrial complex. One of the incredible details from the Economist article, I might get this wrong, but I think they said that in the first week, Israel dropped 6,000 bombs on Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
In the most intense month of the U.S. battle against the Islamic State in Mosul, which was an incredible profit center for the United States, the U.S. dropped 7,000 bombs. The U.S. military-industrial complex is making a tremendous amount of money off of this war. And so the focus is shifting in policy circles, and that is not good for Ukraine.
Do you think America wants Israel to pull back now, or will it just happily go along with whatever it wants to do? Like, if it wants to recreate this for another month or two?
What's fascinating from The Economist is that the Israeli military is planning, has planned for international backlash slowing them down. I think that they have this intense phase of the ground invasion, and then they expect to, I assume, just continuously occupy some parts of Gaza and have more of a... So now the Israeli forces have, I believe, sort of bisected the Gaza Strip, control a strip of territory there. I expect them to continue to control that and use that as a launching space for more targeted attacks. I think that probably by the end of the year, we'll be talking about 20, 30,000 dead. But then the conflict will continue at a much lower level, with Israel maintaining a level of misery in Gaza that forces everybody to leave the north of the Gaza Strip, and probably as many as they can find countries to bribe to take population from the south. So I think already there is some pushback. It's interesting. I mean, there's no question that the U.S. government's support, the Biden administration's support of Israel, is to some extent craven, is humiliating. It almost seems like out of like a 1980s dystopia film. There's something about Anthony Blinken in his suit, you know, the Department of the Secretary of State.
Well, Gaza is very like cyberpunk in a way. It reminds me of the Detroit from RoboCop.
Yes, exactly. The Detroit from RoboCop. And just this idea of Anthony Blinken just looks like this corporate suit from an 80s movie who's saying all these platitudes, and he's flying around to talk to people, and he's just not impacting things really in the slightest. I mean, that's not true. I think he is impacting, you know, he's keeping Arab leaders from going too far off the track. He's doing deals for Israel on the side. He's making certain that Israel has the cover it needs from Iran and Hezbollah to keep doing what it's doing. But there's just something there's something about that image. You know, he's like generically handsome guy in a suit, just sort of walking from a little Paul Bremer, actually, you know, the famously ineffective guy who headed the Iraqi government in the first year after the U.S. conquest. It's very cyberpunk, very dystopian. But what I want to say, it's like the U.S. does not give Israel a fully blank check. The whole point of Iron Dome, which we fund very heavily, is for there to be less Israeli incursions into Gaza. If all of the Gazan missiles just sort of explode harmlessly, then what's the point of going into Gaza? That has been defeated. There was no U.S. president could have stopped the Israeli government from going into Gaza. But it is, I think, pretty instructive that it wasn't just Egypt's Sisi who was shutting down Netanyahu's suggestion that all the Gazans go to Egypt. It was Joe Biden himself. It was like, we're not actually going to fund the straightforward genocide of the Gazan people.
Because isn't there a link with the Islamic Brotherhood with the Gaza Strip, which is one of the reasons why Egypt has sort of been hostile to them for...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's a key point here.
And I don't think they want potentially a million supporters of the Islamic Brotherhood just popping in.
That's certainly part of it, Rory, but I do think it is a legitimate... we don't want to be... And also, not just legitimate, but also Sisi knows that it would be... Sisi himself, the dictator of Egypt, is tremendously insecure, is tremendously... He's a massive failure. He came to power massacring thousands of Muslim Brotherhood political figures. It's interesting. The Muslim Brotherhood won the only free and fair election in Egyptian history that I can point to. Trying to think, maybe in the 1920s during a sort of false dawn of independence. I don't know. And yes, Mohamed Morsi, the democratically elected president of Egypt from, I think, 2012 to 2013, was a member of the Transatlantic Muslim Brotherhood. And, the Transnational Muslim Brotherhood. Hamas is one particularly virulent instantiation of the Muslim Brotherhood. I've made videos in the past. I think the glibness with which U.S. and Israeli commentators paint the Muslim Brotherhood as being the same thing in every country, I think that's deeply incorrect. But for sure, the reason that Sisi has been so eager to participate in maintaining Gaza as an open-air prison is the affinity between Hamas and the democratically elected president of Egypt who died in prison under Sisi's dictatorship. That is definitely something to point to. But Sisi, even given all that, Sisi is not going to be the Egyptian leader who facilitates the ethnic cleansing of Gaza, both for his, certainly for his own personal safety and the safety of his regime, but also to an extent, likely because of some personal principles on his point. It's a no-brainer. For an Arab who cares about the Palestinians, that he's not really down for their ethnic cleansing. And that's a pretty, I would argue, as close to a universal view as you can find in the Arab world.
Can you see it getting, the conflict expanding to include the likes of Lebanon and, Iran proper? Or will it just pretty much just be Gaza being destroyed?
Well, that remains one of the most important questions. It was interesting on Friday, I think it was November 3rd, so this would be a week ago Friday when this is aired, Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah in Lebanon, gave a much advertised speech. They actually had trailers for his speech. It was going to be this tremendously significant event. All of Lebanon, a country that is somewhat captive to Hezbollah. There are many, many factions in Lebanon. Hezbollah is the only effective one. The Lebanese people, I think 68% had no interest in a war with Israel for Gaza, but were terrified that that could happen. The United States was terrified that that could happen. The whole point of the two aircraft carriers I now believe we have in the...
Your favorite?
In the Eastern... Yes, I love those aircraft carriers. In the Eastern Mediterranean, the whole point of those is to intimidate Hezbollah. So everybody was very worried about this speech on November 3rd. And he said, so obviously, very anti-Israel speech. But it was interesting. I don't speak Arabic. I sadly did not take the time to read a translation. But the consensus among... many analysts that I trust who do speak Arabic was that it was a nothing burger, that he was essentially saying, well, we really support Hamas's heroic fight, but we didn't have anything to do with October 7th, and Hamas is doing a great job. They don't need us. So 100%, the option remains for a debilitating trillion-dollar U.S. war in the Middle East. Could have broken out by the time this is uploaded, but so far it hasn't. And that's it was an interesting emotional thing for me. I do not want a wider war, obviously, but it was interesting just sort of reading these results as Nasrallah's speech was being given and being like, wow, like he really, really just abandoned the Palestinians. And thank God, you know, because if he hadn't, there'd have been a horrific body count in Israel and a 10 times larger horrific body count in Lebanon and the distinct possibility of a larger war between the United States and Iran. But it is kind of, it's just incredibly craven, frankly, that, you know, Hezbollah supposedly so committed to this cause as just to send a kickback while Gaza gets ethnically cleansed. And that could change. And I think there was a commentator that I respect was like, well, deterrence worked. We did it. You know, high fives around everyone. Commentator I sometimes respect was sort of like, deterrence worked. And it's let's be careful here. Deterrence worked this week. There are many, many more possibilities. I think it's entirely possible that the Israeli offensive could further intensify from this point. It's entirely possible that the Israeli offensive will go down a number of notches. But the plan for at least northern Gaza is pretty clear and is in the process of being executed. I do not expect large-scale Gazan population to return to the north of Gaza. That may sound pretty cynical, but I think that's kind of already what's happening. Just incredibly dark stuff, Rory. Incredibly dark stuff. Another thing, Mosul is a parallel that keeps coming up. In the war against the Islamic State in 2016-2017. It's actually a pretty good parallel because the Islamic State, as I've argued, as everyone concedes, the Islamic State was created because of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And as I have argued, and I believe most folks who've looked at the details agree, it wasn't just Bush going into Iraq. It was the Obama administration going into Syria and creating a free fire zone for jihadists that sort of really made the Islamic State happen. So the United States, between 2016 and 2017, killed 9,000 civilians bombing Mosul to kill the Islamic State that it had created. Netanyahu government played a large role in Hamas's continued power. And depending on how you read it, the Israeli government in the 80s was very interested in creating a religious alternative to Fatah, to what became the Palestinian Authority, to Arafat's thing. That is kind of a meaningful parallel. But again, the 9,000 civilians were killed by the United States in Mosul over 2 years, between 2016 and 2017. Also a horrendous crime. Don't minimize that. We're talking about... I don't think anybody's really claiming that 1,000 of the 10,000 people that have been killed were Hamas fighters. I've seen some Israeli government claims that only 60 of the people that were killed were Hamas fighters. That's very.
But normally, any males are considered to be combatants.
Yeah, which is more difficult and less significant. Where a figure I saw, I think this came from a United Nations office, I don't know how reputable a United Nations office, that 70% of the people killed in Gaza are women and children. Hamas is a pretty patriarchal, not a lot of women fight, not the Kurds, not a lot of female fighters in the extremist Islamic Hamas. That's just 70% women and children. So that's...
Any glimmers of hope?
What is there to... I mean, it's awesome that Hezbollah has chickened out so far. Hopefully Hezbollah will continue to chicken out. There's certainly I love mocking how low oil prices remain. and continue to be. We've got this massive crisis in the Middle East, and oil prices are now getting almost as low as almost down to the point where Joe Biden is obligated to start refilling the Strategic Petroleum Reserve because the prices are so low. And he's committed to shoring up the oil market. Like, oil prices are so low that it's not Saudi Arabia that's trying to act to raise oil prices. It's the U.S. government. That's a silver lining. But no, there's very little to be optimistic about here, Rory. I mean, I point people to a video I made 2 years ago saying that it's very likely that large-scale ethnic cleansing or genocide is going to become the policy of the Israeli government, and I did not expect it this soon. And it's tremendously sad, and I think it's certainly bad for the long-term prestige of the United States government that it is backing this to the extent that it is.
Well, on that depressing note, we'll catch you next time.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire, What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.